Thank you. Well, many have tried. It's a tough act.
Recommendations or not, or maybe some way to improve those recommendations. We divided the
committee up into subcommittees based on the NSUP document, for instance, medical director, procedures, policies, protocols, and so on and so forth. Each subcommittee is going to come up here and discuss their initial recommendations and get your input. And I do want to emphasize, we want as much input as possible. North Carolina's a big state with a lot of variation and a lot of people who have a lot of expertise and knowledge about what's going on with EMS. And the only way we can have a really good document is be real sure that you give us as much input as you have. And we just really appreciate you coming here. And thanks a whole lot. And most importantly, Joseph Zalkin has been extremely important and helpful in keeping this train on the tracks and also logistics for this meeting and logistics throughout. So I really appreciate all his help and Wake EMS for providing us with this venue and everything they've done. Thank you.
Thank you, Tripp. Let's see who is out there on the phone, if you will. Got about four callers. Someone from the 803 area code. Who are you?
Chris Rosanova, Union County Medical Director.
Thank you, Chris. And from 252.
Hi, this is Juan March from East Carolina University.
And from 919. All right. Anyone else out there on the phone?
Tom Wall from Cone Health, CareLink Medical Director.
Well, guys, we're going to mute you guys on the phone. If you have a question you'd like to ask, if you'll use your touchpad and press 5-star, we'll open up the mute, and that way we can just move on. And we'll ask from time to time as the committees meet.
Conference muted.
So at this point, I think we've got a little bit of change of schedule that we were going to bump ahead. If folks have conflicts, we need input. This is an interactive process. If you look at the history of this project, it started with an open survey to the community at large, the stakeholders asking about this complex group of rules that NSEP manages. It really is important that stakeholders give that feedback. We've got over 860 responses. The majority are from field providers, only 30 from medical directors. Ultimately, this becomes the roadmap for the practice of EMS in North Carolina. And the opportunity to mold that is through these meetings and through feedback through the middle of the year. And then as the committees get their materials together, the new set of procedures, protocols, policies will be forthcoming. We're going to start off today with the EMS procedure group. If you want to come up. And then the schedule pretty much is about 15, 30 minutes worth of discussion per group. We will break for lunch on your own. You'll come back. We'll start back at 1 o'clock and continue the remainder. We are recording today's session, and it will be very important if you've not signed in. And I'll tell you folks on the phone how to sign in. If you've not signed in, especially for medical directors, to get your credit for a workshop. And with that, I'll turn over to Dr. Austin.
Oh, thank you. And this is anyone here for the procedures committee out there, or just me? Looks like just me. So let me go forward. Yeah, we'll whip through this pretty quickly. Which way am I? There we go. So initially with the procedures committee, the first task was to figure out what procedures we needed to revise, what procedures we needed to delete, and what we needed to just keep without revision. So when we initially went through it, we still have 15 in review that I'm waiting to get back, and hopefully we'll have those fairly soon to add to this. But for the other 45, essentially with the initial review, what we split it up was between four of the members of the committee to go through and essentially make a decision to keep with revision or delete. And what we found initially, there were about 24 procedures that really didn't require any revisions. We would just keep and move on. We found 18 that needed revisions, and out of those 18, there are two that I saved for the end that I think probably need some fairly significant discussion amongst this group on how we go about revising it. And initially, we thought we would delete those two, but I think after further discussion, we figured we would bring it to the group and sort of see what everybody thought. So after the committee review, as I said, we took the two that were going to be deleted and moved them up to keep with revision, and we'll discuss those today. So these are keep without revision. And if anyone who's familiar with the procedural document has any objections, wants to make a point, thinks we should change something, let me know. But we have 12-lead ECG all the way down through airway nebulizer inhalation therapy. Anybody have any burning issues on any of those procedures that we think require revision? All right. Moving on. Here we pulse electrical activity should be out of there. We have childbirth through splinting. And we didn't really find anything that needed to be revised in any of these. Anyone else? Anything on there that sticks out? Bothered anyone? All right. And then 47 through 59. And these were all keep without revision. So just maintain the status quo, not change it. Anything here that jumps out? Anybody? We took a good look at tourniquet. I mean, we thought that might be something that we would revise at first, but I don't think it really needs it, nor does hemostatic agent. Any objections? All right. So now let's talk about the revisions. And I apologize, the text is small. This is mostly our notes, and I'll translate that. But number one was the combi tube. One of the questions that came up was how often is the combi tube utilized? It seems like most services have moved towards an LMA and a King, but I still believe that there's a significant number of services in the state that utilize this device, and hence it's probably important that we keep this procedure in place. One of the things that we did note was that in the current procedure, it talks about intubating around the combi tube and deflating the pharyngeal balloon and trying to move it out of the way and intubate around the tube while it's in place. I would make two points on that. One, if your combi tube is in place and it's working, I don't know why you would change it out in the field. It would make no sense to try to do that. Two, if you ran into a situation where it was not functional, you couldn't get it to work correctly, you're probably going to need to remove it anyways. In my experience, you know, trying to intubate around this thing is almost a virtual impossibility. It's just too big and bulky of a device, so our recommendation would be we change the language that if you need to remove the combi, or if you need to intubate around the combi tube, you just take it out, ventilate the patient, and then intubate. Any commentary on that? Everybody good with that? All right. LMA, we thought that you should add a line that says select the appropriate tube size for the patient and completely deflate the cuff prior to insertion. That wasn't contained in the procedural in the current document. It's a fairly small edit. CPAP, we felt that we should add some clinical contraindications, which include decreased mental status, facial features or deformities that prevent an adequate mass seal, excessive respiratory secretion. And then one other question was, there was a recommendation to put an NP airway in place when you utilize this device, and we weren't really sure if that needed to stay in there. So I think the addition of the contraindications is pretty straightforward. NP airway, does anyone use this as their standard practice when they use CPAP to slide an NP in? Anybody?
Make sure there's a relative contraindication.
Yeah.
I think decreased status is a subjective thing. So if we just add the word relative, I'm happy with that.
Okay. Okay. All right. All right. Very good. Very good. So relative contraindications and NP, should it be in there? Out? I don't know. I mean, I don't personally use an NP. Anybody else? Okay. No objections. We'll adopt Brent's friendly amendment and add a relative to that, and then probably pull the NP. Airway introducer, the bougie. I think one thing we might need to clarify is the term hold up. They use the term hold up when using the bougie. I think what that refers to is the sensation of clicking that you get when you're sliding the bougie down the tracheal rings, or potentially it could be when you feed it all the way into the right or left main stem and it just stops. I don't know, does anyone here that put that original language in?
I think that was related to hold up as a primary
problem. Okay, so feeding it until you meet resistance, stopping. We might want to just wordsmith that a little bit and rework it, because when I read through it, it wasn't exactly clear to me as to what hold up meant. I sort of get that there's probably one or two things it means, but we'll just clarify that. I don't think it's a big deal. Airway intubation confirmation is probably worthy of a little bit of discussion. We, in the current airway intubation confirmation procedure, we've blended colorimetric detection and continuous capnography. I think it can still be one procedure, but what we might want to do is split them out a little more clearly, because they're really two different procedures, two different techniques. And you might use them in a slightly different scenario. So I think that's just an editorial piece. We're just going to reformat a little to make it a little more clear. And then the other piece is probably to include some more specific language about the continuous capnography and waveform and referring to your original equipment guidelines for use of that. Any commentary on that, on end-tidal CO2? All right. Airway intubation, confirmation of esophageal bulb. I thought there was one important change, which was to squeeze the bulb completely to remove all air prior to use, and then also recognizing that you shouldn't repeat this test, because you essentially can create a false positive. You can introduce air in the first squeeze into the esophagus, and then on the second squeeze, when you do it again, it expands because it's sucking out the air you already put in. So we should just clarify that you probably have about one opportunity to use this test reliably, and then after that, it's probably not such a good thing to do. Good? Any commentary? All right. Airway respirator operations. I think one thing that is concerning is we strongly recommend that the patient is monitored using end-tidal CO2 and pulse oximetry while on a transport event. I felt that it should not be a strong recommendation. I felt that it should be a requirement. I mean, if you're going to put somebody on a transport event, I think the standard of care probably should be that you utilize continuous capnography and utilize continuous pulse oximetry while they're on the transport vent under your care. Does anyone have any heartburn over that? Is this going to create a logistical or financial issue for any service?
Eric, the only thing I would point out is that the respirator is really a VLS device, whereas the ventilator is the ALS device.
Mm-hmm.
So the respirator is really kind of the device that, maybe goes with, a resuscitation, component like a pump or something like that. So capnography in that setting may or may not be available.
Yeah. So clarification, respirator.
Just the difference between a respirator and a ventilator. I think
right.
It was in the document, but
That would be the only thing, because there's really no transport vent specific protocol or procedure then.
There is a ventilator. There's an airway respirator and an airway ventilator operation.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe we could. I'll take a look at that and sort of see. But from the standpoint of the ventilation, you know, I think we should probably change that from a strong recommendation to a requirement. I mean, if you're going to put somebody on a transport vent, you should have that capability.
So I'm with you 100%.
I'm distinguishing
the difference between the two, because a respirator could be used by an EMT basic.
Right. I guess that's true. There's probably a respirator portion. So defibrillation automated was just essentially to modify the pad position to avoid placing directly over an implanted device. This is just consistent with the 2010 AHA guidelines. This is just a slight modification to what we already have. Defibrillation manual, really the same thing, talking about modifying pad or paddle placement. And then keep with revision for 37 gastric tube insertion. Essentially, unconscious patient or ad oral airway placement can be attempted after securing airway. I think the concern when this was reviewed was that essentially that you would try oral placement without the airway secured, and that it was just clarifying language. And then in pulse oximetry, there was a recommendation that we add factors such as supplemental oxygen is not required if the saturation is greater than or equal to 94%, unless there are obvious signs of heart failure, dyspnea, or hypoxia to maintain 94%. That we would include that language, which is consistent with the 2010 guidelines, just an update of this.
We've got questions on the phone, so hold on one second. Juan, go ahead with your question.
Hi, this is Juan March. I'm sorry to go back a little bit. Didn't realize I needed to do the five-star to get back online here. In regards to the capnography protocol, I'm sorry, not capnography, CPAP, there were two questions that got brought up by some of my medics. One was to consider the use of end-tidal CO2 when using capnography. I don't know if folks have realized it, but they can actually put the nasal cannula underneath the mask, and it still maintains a real good seal, and you can kind of see where the patient's going in regards to the end-tidal CO2. And then the second one was in regards to the pressures. It talks about titrating slowly, but starting at a pressure of 5 millimeters in CHF. And the reality is most of us probably start at 10 and work our way up from there. And just something to consider on the protocol.
Mm-hmm. So, Juan, two recommendations. One would be to add a line regarding essentially side stream capnography, if available, right?
That's correct.
Which I think is legitimate. It's you know that's going to be service specific, so that would be, you know, sort of if available, you should utilize that tool. And then the second piece would be would the recommendation be to parameters for where you would start with pressure or?
Yeah, I think the as I recall, and I'm pulling it up here, the protocol for CPAP for congestive heart failure recommends procedures to start at 5 to 10 millimeters, with really 5 being really physiologic. And so my recommendation would be to increase that to start at 10. And then I think the difference between CHF and COPD is the reality that maybe those patients should be titrated quickly as opposed to slowly titrate as tolerated. So get rid of the word slowly, I think, would be enough.
Okay. So moving from 5 to 10, any comments from the room on that? Is everybody comfortable with a move from 5 to 10 as a starting point?
don't know that all devices currently use RFPN, unfortunately, reach
standards. Right. Yeah, I mean, the one problem you might have with that is that certain devices have a specific valve and services only carry one specific pressure. I guess you could up the range a little bit. What we'll do is we'll take a look at that, and if anyone in the group has a specific thought on that, please email one of us and let us know how you would like that language changed or what you think would work best. All right. Thank you, Juan. Anything else? And then finally, pulse oximetry. Any heartburn with essentially putting in a line about supplemental oxygen not being required if the saturations are 94 or greater, unless there are those caveats? Good. All right. The reperfusion checklist. The question was adding age greater than or equal to 18, and then a few minor changes to it. And we were thinking of adding a physical tear-out, revising the physical tear-out checklist. So not much different there. Yeah.
What's the evidence for that?
For the reperfusion checklist?
For changing the age greater than 18 or to say we already have CNS diseases, and the reason I'm getting at this is stroke care is going to revolve around this, and so we've got medics in the field that are having to use this on a daily basis about where they're going to transport stroke victims, either now or in the near future.
Right.
The less complicated the reperfusion checklist is, the better. And maybe I'm just ignorant of the evidence. I don't know about the evidence for greater or less than 18 these days. But it's not that we have many patients with stroke under 18, but a single cell patient is somebody very well may.
Right. Who might fall into that category. Okay. Any other comments on that? So how about adding history of aneurysm or ABM to a list of structural CNS diseases? Do you think there's value, or keep it simple? Brent would like to keep it simple.
Yeah, I really would. And
that second?
You know, and I'm putting my family on the line with this, because the only EMS agency that I know of that gives CPA in the field based on this checklist is the one that responded to my parents' house.
Okay.
And I would rather them say, you have CNS disease than try to get down to the weeds with it.
Okay. So there is a second. Anyone opposed to just leaving it as it is? Raise your hand. Otherwise, I assume everybody's okay with it. Done. All right, we'll leave the reperfusion checklist as is. Spinal mobilization, we thought that there was sort of a missing piece. You almost need to add a statement about special equipment, such as football players and full pads. That sometimes I've seen there's a little bit of confusion over who should keep their helmet on and who should have their helmet removed. And so I thought it would be useful to have a clarifying statement regarding essentially if you're immobilizing someone who's in full pads and a helmet, their airway is intact, then you're probably not going to be removing that helmet. You're going to be immobilizing them as they lay. Whereas somebody that's wearing a motorcycle helmet, like a full bar helmet, and has got their head, like that when they're on a backboard, you're probably going to need to remove that helmet prior to packaging and transport. So just some clarification around different equipment. Everybody okay with that? Okay. All right, stroke screen. One recommendation would be that there are several stroke screens that people use. Some people use Cincinnati. Some people use LA. There are a couple others out there that are probably also acceptable. I don't think there's any compelling evidence that one is particularly superior to another, so I would probably leave it up to the service to choose which stroke screen they would like to use.
and we could list several examples. Anyone have any discomfort with that? Okay. Moving on, temperature. There was a recommendation to remove language regarding the equilibrium phase, that you should let a patient come to equilibrium before you check their temperature. And, you know, I think it was just a nuanced edit piece. So the recommendation was to remove that. IV, one of the questions was, should you specify lactated rigors for burns, normal saline for trauma, or hypotension, or just leave it as crystalloid? Do we want to get it? And this gets into, this is very similar to Brent, what Brent's just raised. Do we want to get into the weeds and identify, like in this, you would use this type of crystalloid, or do we just want to say crystalloid and leave it up to the surface?
Leave it.
Crystalloid and leave it up to the surface? Okay. Very good.
It just coming in or going
on? Okay. Intraosseous, a recommendation was made to add burns to indications and also to add the humerus insertion site because right now only the tibial insertion site is used or is referenced. Any problems with humerus? Everybody like the humerus?
I like the humerus. I just don't know anatomically if we should limit our be specific because there are other locales,
yeah,
sternum and what have you, that may be efficacious in the right set. That I think the local medical director ought to define what his sites of preference would be.
Okay. So Joe's recommendation is because there are different devices, and essentially some of those devices are sternal devices, and others are long bone devices. Should we just make it much more general and broad and saying that the local medical director should decide what sites to utilize for their specific device? Okay. Anyone? Everybody in agreement on that, that we'll essentially broaden that out so that it will leave it up to the local agency and based on the device you're using? All right. Taser dart removal, the recommendation was that we should add language about removing the taser dart with pliers or hemostats to prevent puncture wound CMS personnel. It seems like good common sense. I don't know.
This comes up on the equipment side.
Right, then you would have to carry said item. I don't know. What do you guys think? Can of worms?
But consider.
Consider. Right.
These are pulled out by the police when we get there anyway.
Right. Okay. All right. We'll use very loose terminology such as consider. All right. Fair enough. So those are the 20 that we're to keep with, or those were the 18 that we figured would be relatively not very contentious. So, Joe, I'll be able to get a tape of this.
We hope. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Good. All right. So I'm not going to go back through and review it. I'm just going to review the transcript and make changes as discussed.
So I think McKenzie's keeping notes, right, as things come up. And you guys on the phone, if you have a question, press 5-star and we'll unmute your line.
Okay. So we'll move on to these two, which we're keep with revision, but I think are worthy of some discussion. So we'll do number 12, which is nasotracheal intubation first. We actually pulled this data and found that last year there were 400 plus nasotracheal intubations in North Carolina, which sort of surprised me because I you know sort of looked at our own data and you know thought that. I mean, we almost never use this procedure, so I figured that probably the same was true throughout the state, but clearly, you know, there are people using nasotracheal intubation.
You got the data from where?
Alan pulled it out of premise. So, I mean, Greg, do you think that data is correct?
Was that a successful? I think that's a testament.
Yeah.
But no, that's...
Well, I'll take as my going-in bias. My going-in bias is that this is an infrequently used procedure, and, you know, I know that there are a subset of providers we have in the state that were well-trained in this procedure, you know, are probably very competent at it. But most of us have, you know, probably come through the system since, you know, the mid-90s don't have a lot of experience either in training or actually doing this. And so my bias was, well, maybe we should take this out because it potentially is a pathway that can be distracting and cause complications, and you know, if you're not skilled with it. But clearly, you know, there are places in the state utilizing it. So I think given the fact that we still have a number of services that use nasal tracheal intubation, you know, my recommendation at this point, we just sort of revise it and keep it.
You must be on mute.
I am.
That is having fun.
That's why he's making noise, so we'll mute him again.
All right. Thoughts on nasal tracheal intubation?
I'd say leave it to the local medical director, still have it in there.
Yeah.
But the service may choose not to use it.
Yeah.
But to completely remove it, you're taking something away from the skilled providers that actually use it.
Yeah. The flip side of that coin is it a safe and effective procedure? And that's a difficult question to answer that maybe is the local level.
The question that Greg said, that those are probably attempts. Is there a way to identify how many were actually successful?
Yeah,
and then make the decision about whether or not it's really a procedure that should stay.
Right, yeah. Define success.
Could we do maybe just a quick flash poll for the folks who know their backyard data? Just show of hands where nasal intubation is used in your organization.
We've used it how many times in the last year? Going like,
and I think CPAP for sure has dropped that category.
I guess it's about 5 years to go out of the
protocol. I think the challenge is, Eric, is that in systems that don't do RSI, you know, this is someone who's breathing and potentially, you know, has a gag reflex, so a blind insertion device may or may not work. There may be clenched teeth kinds of scenarios. So it's kind of a bridge procedure that may allow someone that doesn't do RSI to get an airway. So it's difficult to take it away unless you're going to, you know, really promote RSI. I don't know if we want to do that on the flip side.
Yeah.
So
my bias is we need better. I trained because that's all there was, but there's been a lot of folks in programs since with CPAP reducing the need that they may not necessarily train and retrain on this seldom used procedure. My guess is we have it available in Wake County, and we don't have a problem with it when it's utilized, but it's only utilized in a small population. Mm-hmm. And like Greg said, it's probably a population that, you know, we don't RSI here, so it's that for a certain, you know, a more aggressive airway. I think it's one of those things that should be footnoted as other skills come about that will be potentially higher risk but seldom used to ensure that that's part of both initial and continuing education.
Well, I would, you know, I certainly agree with both those statements. I mean, I would say that probably, you know, keeping it to revision is fine, but I think this is definitely falls, and there are probably a couple things like this, procedures that we really need to dig deep into and look at and monitor, because, you know, my gut feeling is that we probably don't have a whole lot of success, you know, when we try this procedure. Now I don't know if that's completely true, but my sense is we probably don't have a whole lot of success. There are a limited number of providers. You know, so I mean, just thinking back to those of us in the room, those of us that went through, you know, paramedic class in the 80s, even then, this late 80s is sort of falling out of favor. You know, the really skilled nasotracheal innovators, at least that I've run across, were probably trained clearly before 1990. And maybe even a little bit before. And some of those people, they're like those folks that can figure out where water is just using two sticks. I mean, they're really good, you know. But they're few and far between. Not everybody can do that. So I think we'll keep it with a revision. But my recommendation would be is that we really start to look at this procedure carefully and figure out, because I I worry that it's not a safe or effective procedure in most cases. That's my piece on that.
We've got a question. Juan.
Hi, it's Juan March again. Is there data from PREMIS in regards to the success rate for the nasotracheal intubations compared oral compared to RSI and drug-assisted?
That's what I think we want to get at, Juan, is Alan got me the data that there were 400 and something utilizations of nasotracheal intubation, but I think the question is, were those successful, or is there a subset that was successful?
I can tell you that the data is not going to be good enough to make a decision on that. That was 400 cases and not across the state like that. So I think you can get the number of times the procedure is done, but I think getting down to a clinical decision, it's not going to happen.
So the answer is no, Juan. All right. So we'll revise it and then probably, you know, closely follow up. I think Greg, it is worth revisiting. It is one of those things we probably should look at. So airway intubation drug assisted, and I think this is an important one worthy of some discussion, and it sort of bleeds over into the scope of practice piece. You know, my feeling is if we're going to have a drug-assisted, you know, intubation program, we should probably more clearly define it than it's defined in this procedural protocol. I mean, is this bad as a short checklist? Probably not. But, you know, if somebody's going to run an RSI program, I think there's got to be a lot more meat than what exists on this single piece of paper. So that was sort of my feeling on it. And obviously there's clear bleed into the scope of practice piece. So I don't know, Greg, if you wanna address that or not.
I guess what's your question specifically?
Well, specifically, if we're gonna have a service that does RSI, there's a certain level of training, there's a certain level of quality assurance, there's a certain level of essentially, you know, ongoing quality management to prove that you're doing it safely and effectively. And do we define that really anywhere? Is this the place to define it?
Well, I mean, it's somewhat defined in the sense that in the, you know, you have to have two paramedics, you have to have cath artistry and pulse oximetry, you have to have followed up with an airway form. And, you know, those get sent in to the state medical directors for, you know, quarterly at least track and monitor things. So at the time that we went through this during the last revision, those were the things that were put into place to satisfy both NSF and to some degree the medical board that at least this was being monitored closely by a physician. So I guess the question is there something more restrictive than that you would like to do? I think I could probably give you a better sense operationally of whether that's possible to monitor or not if you had ideas of how you wanted to, you know, to be more restrictive or more constraining. But we still tended to leave this to a local implementation, you know, with the medical director monitoring this and by using the airway evaluation form. That was our method of at least assuring that there was some ongoing quality maintenance and monitoring.
Greg, do we have numbers? That roughly?
We do.
Do it, success rate, how many attempts?
I don't, off the top of my head, know the numbers. Did you get those with the other procedures?
No, I haven't pulled the airway form.
I mean, I can go back and pull numbers on the RSIs. Again, we don't always get the ability to distinguish those from normal intubation, but we get a general sense, and then certainly on the airway forms, I think I had done the math a few months ago. I think I received probably about 400 or so airway forms in the last year, and there were less than 10 that had any issues, and only 2 that really made me cringe.
Mm-hmm.
And with all of those, they were addressed. So
you need to be real careful about a specialized training program, too, on what you may require. Our local hospital won't let us in the OR. So.
Yeah, but you need to be really careful about a procedure that can immediately cause death. So.
Well, you do, but if you start, if you lay out a specialized training for it, that could rule some people out if they don't have access.
And that might not be a bad day. I say this honestly. I mean, there are state programs that very clearly specify what sort of training, what sort of regular quality assurance goes on. Honestly, I just am concerned that without having those, sort of elements in place, that you run the risk of having a program where you've got some services that do it at a very, very high level and do it successfully. And you have other people that, they had a four-hour class on what these drugs are, and, somebody takes a look at the form after it's done, and, that's about it. I mean, that's the worry. I mean, we know that RSI in most of the published literature is not extremely beneficial in this specific application. So, my concern, Greg, would be is are we taking a rigorous enough look at this procedure, knowing what the current state of the literature is?
Well, I would probably pass this back to even looking in the emergency department. And so, for instance, some of the things that we found in the cases that we did identify issues is that many times the EMS agency that performed the RSI procedure wasn't the issue. It was an issue on the handoff to an air medical crew or to a special care transport crew or even to PED. And so it brings in an issue of kind of total airway management. And just with any airway issue, typically, handoffs and transfer of care are where things happen. And so the other thing that we still don't have a great handle on, even though we can have an airway form that looks pristine from the standpoint of they have all this documentation monitoring, it's like some of the stuff out of San Diego, is that there can still be periods of time when you go back and query the device where there was hypoxia or issues during the procedure itself, which are never documented or part of that. So at some point, this becomes a peer review analysis and ongoing monitoring of a procedure. And just like when we go into do a trauma designation, for instance, we always find issues of care, and we expect that. So what we tend to look at is how well it was caught, how well it was managed, and what was put in place was happening again. And that's where we were moving as a state, trying to really encourage more aggressive peer review and local medical direction involvement and those kinds of things. So I think from a high-level state perspective, we're doing probably as much as we can do to support quality of care in the system. So I don't think that you're going to get the state to be able to really help in any additional way for this. Regardless of what you put down on paper, it still locally has to be carried out.
Yeah, I guess you have a more defined program. Sort of along the lines of what Massachusetts has, which is a very specific training program and monitoring. And essentially, what it does, like any restriction, limits who gains entry to the program. But what you're doing is hopefully ensuring quality. I think that's the main concern, is that an RSI program is not problematic unless, there's not a lot of oversight and it's not well run. The question would be, when you talk about the follow-up data, if you're doing RSI, I would say your compliance on follow-up, for your airway sheet should be 100%. I mean, it shouldn't be 30%. It should be 100%. So, I don't know. I personally have a lot of concern with the one sheet describing an RSI program. I understand what you're saying about the state level, but I would my preference would be is that we spend some time and look at what other states are doing and maybe better define this program because of the high risk.
No, I would welcome that. I think that again, that the thing you have to do as you go through that though is try to identify how
anyone can assure that happens.
Right.
So, in other words, giving them guidance, giving them suggestions, setting up curriculums, all those kinds of things are very possible and doable and have been done in other places. But, again, when it comes back to actually assuring that that happens, that's where it becomes challenging. Because from a state perspective, we can't really be sick on that in general, because we're going to monitor and make sure that they're filling out forms and that they're discussing them. But it doesn't necessarily, monitoring doesn't equate to quality.
Yeah, I've noticed just around the trauma center I work at, I've had lots of patients come in, no airway form, they never presented an airway form to be filled out. There was one county where I asked the paramedic, where is your airway form for the RSI? He said, what airway form? He's never heard of it. And so I think there's a big gap in how often those forms are actually filled out, too. And I don't know how you correct that. So we may have a flawed system. But ultimately, there are controls at the local level with a system plan and peer review. There's a local medical director on who's tagged. The guidance comes from NSEP. The reporting in another section, the QI components of reporting, could be adopted through the NSEP document. Having a third-party airway standard, like another state's program, if that's adopted, could be pointed to again through the NSEP document. It is the one item other than mask trousers and CPAP that came up on the survey over and over and over again. And understand, 80% of the surveys were filled out by field personnel. So RSI is sort of like that third rail. It is risky. It may not, in the grand scheme of evidence-based medicine, be beneficial in pre-hospital setting. It's either allowable with the defined mechanism set down by the rules, and the quality improvement reporting, et cetera, are locally based and affirmed by the state. I think that's, it's the equivalent of state rights kind of stuff that we've been hearing as we've gone through the document and the feedback. There are communities in this state that hold, out of my dead hands are you taking my rocuroni? That they believe that is their option because it's provided. So I would hate the document to restrict. It should inform and it should be standardized.
I would take a different view. I would take the view that, really at the level of this committee and the state, the job should be to set the bar. And then it's at the local level to jump over that bar. And what I'm telling you right now is the bar is too low. I mean, the bar doesn't clearly define how high or how far anyone needs to jump. And so I've got no problem with someone who can clear the bar, running a quality program, but I'm a little worried that, we have a lot of services out there running a program that they're not even submitting the data on. I mean, that's worrisome, right?
Well, on that note, we might better, very good discussion. We need to definitely approach it more and deal with it more. We might better move on to the next section at this point. Otherwise, we'll be here till 6.
All right. So
that's a great comment.
So we'll move on.
How do you view that in the specialty care program? Because for us, we already do the monitor in place, and I pulled my data from last year. It's 107 out of 108 that were successful by my providers. One was done by an ED provider, and then there was one surgical practice.
Yeah.
So that success rate there for the specialty care
for your locally generated data. The question is, the question is not whether can this program be successful. The question is how do you guarantee that it's successful across the state? I mean, can you run a successful RSI program? Absolutely. But the question is, how do you set the threshold? So, I don't know. Joe and I will kick this around, and I'll bring back some other state guidance for the next meeting, and we'll discuss this at length. So, all right.
Great.
Good enough. So, next steps, discuss revisions that we talked about, revise things as needed. The final meeting has been moved up to the 13th, I take it?
Okay.
Two other little things. One was adding a CO monitoring protocol, which we're working on. The other is adding a hypothermia protocol, both of which are procedure. I'm sorry, but both of which were requested. Are there any other procedural additions that anyone thinks should be made other than these two?
Just going through some of the medical board stuff and being the subcommittee chair and medication skills, of course, some overlap in our subcommittees. I'll just run through them. They're pretty minor. You can decide, group can decide what to do with them all. In the survey, 15 lead EKG came up. I don't know if you just want to modify the 12 lead document and incorporate that. That was one small item. We've got carbon monoxide. We don't have a procedure for external device for chest compression. There's several commercial devices out there. I think that should be considered as well as being added. There's not a procedure for chest tube maintenance that I could find. That document is in the medical board documentation, something that we're, of course, approved to do. Then the final item was transmucous pacing, just maintenance of that. So those are just some items that I had come across that were not any NSF documents that have been listed in the medical board documentation over the years, something that we've considered.
Matt, can you also introduce yourself to people?
I'm sorry, I'm Matt Harvey from First Health.
Okay, so really, really making those procedures sync with what's the scope of practice time.
Right.
Okay. I think that's fair to probably add those. I mean, if it's in the scope of practice, there should be a procedure associated with it.
All right. One last thing. Is there any other thoughts since we kind of specifically put line insertion for Combi Tube, LMAs, King Airways? I mean, there's a multitude of them out there. Are we going to have to specify every single one if you choose to do another device that comes out?
I probably...
Or do you do a general blind insertion airway device as per manufacturer guidelines for...
Having
four or five of them there. Right?
Yeah, I mean, you might be able to combine those into a single blind insertion airway device, an approved blind insertion airway device. Eliminate that. All right. Anything else? All right.
Good job. Right. Anybody on the phone have questions before we swap off? 5-star, we'll open you up.
Thank you, Eric.
No problem.
Great work. Appreciate all the time y'all spent on that.
Sure. All right. No questions from the phone? This is good. This is good interaction. I got to look around this room and see that many of us started at the early days. That's for Tom Griggs. And are still around, but if you think about how we've modified practice and services, what Eric said was true. State of North Carolina has always set the bar, and locals have had that ability to go above and beyond. And it's the Murphy Manio approach that everyone has that opportunity. And I can tell you, traveling around the country, not all the other communities have that common sense. And they face problems when they buy them. Next up is the skills and medication. We have a representative.
Yeah.
Come on up. And again, if you're on the phone line and you want to ask a question, your line's muted, press 5-star, and we'll open it up for you.
Just in everyone, all the subcommittee chairs' offenses, I was the one putting their slides into one presentation last night. So they looked bad, and there's a problem with it. It's my fault. So.
You didn't make mine nice and pretty?
They were nice and pretty.
Yeah, they were nice and pretty. I'm going to hopefully get us a little bit back on track because our section is pretty simple and straightforward. Got Brendan Berry and Brent Myers here that are also on the subcommittee. I'll leave it up to you as to whether you want to stretch your legs and come up or not. We may be done before you even get up here, right? So because there's so much overlap between what you just heard and what you're going to hear in the near future with respect to medications, we've kind of taken the approach that We want to focus on kind of skill level and are the levels appropriate for what is listed underneath all the skills of medication. So without any further ado, I've kind of broken this up into three areas. In this subset of proposed changes from our subcommittee really just involve making changes from it being FCT required to optional. And under those, under that change, we're proposing that femoral line access should be changed to optional, as well as just a clarification about drug-assisted intubation, having the pediatric tag added to it. I think there was some question with respect to the survey results as to whether that was both adult and pediatric. And then finally, just making vasopressin an optional requirement. And again, these are just for SCT. They're just basically proposed changing the S, O in that column to O for both paramedic SCT level. Comments, thoughts, suggestions there? Again, there's not a real lot of changes that we have here, but we thought that those were, for various reasons, again, femoral line, just because of the advent of much more prominent use of IO, we thought that that was less significant of a skill that should be required. I'm not going to get into the RSI, but there's already been plenty of discussion of that. Vasopressin just, you know, attempting to keep up with guideline changes. As far as these skills, these are things that I just mentioned a couple of minutes ago. When I reviewed the medical board documents with respect to NCEP protocol documents, there were just a few items that were left out. And, of course, we would just list these recommendations as SCT optional again. And Eric, can, and we can talk about further about getting those in as procedures, but we would recommend those at the SCT optional level. So that would be an O in that final column as well. That's, I think, just more of a completeness issue than anything else. Comments, suggestions on those few items? And then finally, these are a couple more items to be added as far as a completeness sense, and these would be added across all skill levels. So external devices, the commercial devices that are out there, and the carbon monoxide, as Eric had mentioned a few minutes ago. So there are probably not many comments there either. And again, we can make more comments as we get into protocols and medications, but we've just attempted to focus on the skill level and making some minor modifications to those. But as you can see, I think we pretty much agree that procedures, skills, medications are pretty much where we think they ought to be from a skill level, and we'll be interacting with the other subcommittees as changes to protocols and medications are made. Brendan, anything else for the group?
Well, that pretty well covers it. I just wanted to kind of clarify your slide before. So it's not so much that this is SCT, that this would be open EMTP across the board, so it would just be O for those categories.
Oh, Brendan, can you introduce yourself? Yeah.
Brendan Berry, Medical Director of White Med Mobile.
Very good.
Just one other comment, which was if there are medications on the medication list in which the EMS system has no protocol, then they should not be required. In other words, I mean, Lasix comes to mind. We don't use Lasix anymore. So there should be no form that the fourth motion state has to come and inspect, because it's on our list, even though there's no utilization in our system for that medication. So somehow to put that phraseology in there that if it's been approved that medicine's not part of your local protocol, because we have a glove box full of lasers right now, that's where we keep it, so people aren't tempted to use it, but it's able to take them to inspect and that kind of stuff.
What is Lasix right now? Is it on the list of
the list I'm on?
Thank you. You know, I am
probably. And no, there's no way in the protocols where Lasix can be utilized in our system. And I'm sure there's various ones of those. that happens, and I'm not saying right or wrong, but that's just an example. I'm not
right, but it's currently listed as optional. So.
Well, it's not listed as optional state medication. So we just need to clarify that if it's an optional medication and there's no protocol, then you don't have to care.
Right.
Here
goes my
leg. But if there are medicines that are not on that list, how do you petition the medical
board to add them? Yeah, I think I'm going to defer to the medications subcommittee, but I'll fix that, because you've addressed that in your.
We'll talk more when we get to the medication. I'm definitely on the MSO at UNC Chapel Hill and the chair of the subcommittee on medication. In all of the comments that we received, including the survey, including discussions, including these meetings, there were only 7 medications that were recommended to be added that were not already included in the North Carolina Medical Board's approved list of medications. We're probably veering off track here, but the point is that the drug list that's contained in the back of the protocol document, as I think we've said several times now, is not that's not the medical board list. That's a list of 50 or so medications, and it's essentially just a catalog of what's in the protocol. The North Carolina Medical Board approved list, which is available, and I have a link in my presentation, I'm sure most of you have seen it anyway, has not only 50 or 60 medications, but 20 plus classes of medications that are approved for use by EMS personnel. So I think one thing to address, which we'll talk about a little bit later, is should your system use a, for example, a specific narcotic that another system may not use, fine. I mean, clearly there's a system-specific drug list. The question is how to reflect that in a statewide document. And I think that a lot of it is what was alluded to earlier, is not necessarily changing language or potentially changing some language, or at least alluding to the fact in the INSEP standards document, that this isn't necessarily an INSEP standards document issue. It's an issue of understanding what the state's looking for when they come checking on your handle. So that's a little bit of an aside. The answer as far as how to petition the medical board for adding medication is probably best addressed by after years. We've talked about that a little bit later, but there's only a small number of men, none of which are probably a good idea. This is suggesting that we add to that list.
Because people who want to think like ketamine and propofol, and the medical board basically said no way.
Okay.
But more from you later during your regular.
Any
other questions, comments? Any questions from the phone? 5-star. We'll open you up. Related to skills and medication.
Thanks a lot, Matt. Appreciate that.
Equipment. I have no idea what the slides will say, Brent, but come on up.
I've got my own paper. We don't like slides.
Thought y'all were bringing your
own.
Oh, really? Well,
good.
We said it impromptu.
Oh, yeah, that's fine. Is the whole thing here? Because if not, we can just go to the website
and
scroll down to the list.
That's it, I think.
Okay, I've got the comments by the list. So, talk about yourselves for 2 seconds. I'll just go to the list.
Again, the bathrooms are through here. Go through the door that looks like a fire door.
And we do have seats. If y'all don't want to stand in the back, we've got seats intermingled here. I think most of these folks bathe before coming. And be happy to let you sit the rest of your... It's not that far from the back.
Yeah, why don't we take a moment and if everybody can kind of introduce themselves, starting with Terry Barber.
Terry Barber, Wilson County, man. I'm an old dog. Been around a long time.
Seth Lawson, First County, New Dyson.
Jenny Cadet Crawford, VMS.
Tom Mitchell, Office of VMS.
Amory Brown, Office of VMS.
Mackenzie Cook, Office of VMS.
David Dickens, Durham County. Brandon Mitchell, Durham County.
Kevin Underhill, Durham County.
Brandon Berry, Wake Man.
Rob Edwards, Carolina Air Care.
Jules Wish, Nash Kansas,
Chris Parker, Wilson County, EMS.
Dennis Patsy, Warren Cannon.
Matt Harmony, First Health.
Mark Rollins, First Health.
Jeff Williams, First Health.
Tom Graves, Highway Patrol.
Kirk Harrison, Highway Patrol.
Tom Patsy.
Jim Albright, Dover County.
Dave Taylor, Deer County.
Josh Holloman, Johnson County.
Billy Langston, Johnson County.
Greg Collins, Seth Kemp.
John Wilson, Seymour Community College.
Greg Jordan, Seymour
Community College.
Marshall, Frank, Mountjoy County.
John Judger, Mountjoy County.
Aaron Burston, Romaine County.
John Bender, Romaine County.
Richard Clark, Paul Frank.
John Wendell,
Myers from Wake County, so we had this up and ready to go now. So we've had 13 pages of comments that we reviewed about the standards for equipment. We have referred some of them to the English and Grammar Subcommittee and some of the others to various other committees. But beginning with the comments, the first comment is under optional, and I think this may not be necessary, but just was a point of discussion, is that the optional equipment must have either a policy, protocol, or procedure to go with it. And I think that probably is already covered by the state, but that was just a comment. So, some clarifying things. Most of the questions here were simply clarifying, and there's a few that were not, and we'll come to those. The first several comments came under blind insertion airway device, which was reflected earlier, which is they want a generic blind insertion airway device rather than a policy for each particular vendor or type. So there were multiple comments that said just leave it blind insertion airway and let the individual systems talk about how you utilize that and have education for that. So I don't think that changes this list. I think it's just a clarifying statement. There were probably 8 or 10 comments about the endotracheal sizes and that having them stop at 7.0 is too small and that requiring all 10 all the way up is unnecessary. So what the general consensus of the comments was that you should have 10 sizes of cup tubes from 2.5 to 9.0, and you just decide which ones you think your system needs, rather than just prescribing that. That was the general consensus. So that makes sense to me. Yes.
Right. The only thing I'd be careful about, and I don't know if you've got the document, but the EMS for Children's program actually follows the recommended ACS equipment list for ambulances. And our funding coming into the state is based on maintaining that baseline set of equipment that's in that list. And so the sizes on most of these things, especially down at the pediatric level, are what we're required to do federally for these grants.
I think the concern was not the low end, the concern was the high end.
Okay.
Was that stopping at 7.0, most systems don't do that.
Okay.
Yeah. But a point we'll take, we'll make sure that whatever the pediatric sizes are maintained.
But that's why as you go through this, you're going to see a lot of pediatric equipment. But that's just what's being pushed down by the federal system for us.
The next clarification was, does a video laryngoscope count as a laryngoscope? That was just a question. If systems have the plenty of money laying around and they want to buy the fancy video laryngoscope, I don't know that we need to change the equipment list. But that question came about 4 different times. Salt airways, do they count as OPAs? That question came up about 6 different times, which is, it really is just a glorified OPA. So, I mean, I think our recommendation would be to count it as an OPA if people want to utilize it. The number and size of nasopharyngeal airways, is that also from the pediatric list?
On the small end, it is.
On the small end. We were thinking like McDonald's, you know. Small, medium, and large.
Yeah, so if you go back and see it, I have to know you can actually pull it off as well.
Okay, then we'll find the one. folks, because there's a lot of comments about the numbers of all of these things, and the pediatric was notwithstanding, that there seems to be an overabundance of sizes. There were a lot of folks that argued about the size of the needle for chest decompression, that, you know, we can get way off base here, so let's not. The question being that we know the evidence suggests that a lot of these are not successful if they are smaller needles. We know that's true. Blackwell actually had a great paper to that notion. So the question comes, is there a way to phrase this that everybody's more comfortable with? I'm willing to take suggestions.
One's got to come.
Okay. Yes, sir. Never mind.
Go ahead, Juan.
Just, that's Juan. Just a clarification regarding the video laryngoscope. To clarify, would that be something that's optional or that could be used to replace the standard traditional laryngoscope?
I think our view is that it's optional.
Just wanted to clarify that.
Yes, thank you. Many comments about adding the bougie and where that would come in. I think it's kind of playing a little fast and loose to say it is a stylet, but I guess you could call it that, or do we need to add it to the list as an option? I don't think anybody's talking about requiring it, but I think just leave it as a stylet, and we're fine with that if everybody else is fine with it. We weren't going to require it anyhow. Where does CPAP fall? There were about a comment on every other page about CPAP, and does it fit on this list somewhere, and if it does, where, and if not, do we need to add it? The only place we could possibly see that it might fall would be under a pressure or volume with PEEP. I mean, technically, that could qualify as CPAP. Does it need a separate listing, or should we just leave it under that as an option?
I think it should be listed separate, and the reason is we are trying to influence CMS and others that this one specific device has such an impact on our patient population that there should be compensation for the associated use of it. And I think it would help to say specifically you have a device, optional or required, and at what level, I don't know, but it'd be lined in.
I think there were several comments that were, once we have the ride the wave taken care of, and we've got entitled CO2 and 12 lead, that the next thing that dollars should go for was likely CPAP, and to argue that it could be a BLS skill even, which is an entirely separate discussion from here. But to list it separately, at least get it optional so it's on the radar screen, seems to make some sense. The notion about two pad sizes, and again, this may go back to some pediatric requirement that we have, but we know the AHA says it doesn't matter. But if we need to leave that for pediatric reasons, we will. Otherwise, there was some fairly solid recommendations to remove that two-pad requirement.
Let's check that. I think it is.
Yeah, it's in pediatric. In other words, the AHA recommendation is basically electricity is good. Just get us there. The AAP is saying you need to still try to create a reasonable test.
So who is going to pay for that? Because, I mean, seriously, for me, that's 400 and some odd pad set that I've got to replace every year for BLS first response that will never, ever, ever get used. So if there's grant money from PEDS coming, then we need the grant money to pay for that. Because I cannot in good conscience spend the taxpayers' money of Wake County on pediatric pads for every first responding fire apparatus.
I've noted that.
Can't do that. That's doing it on transport units is one thing, having pediatric pads available for 12 lead monitors that are there, but the first response out the door is a tremendous financial burden for very little benefit. The other comment that came out is that convalescent AED is optional. And there were several comments that basically, if it says ambulance on the side, be it convalescent or no, that the public would expect there to be at least an AED available. That might also be a financial burden for convalescent services. I mean, I think we have to say that on the table. But there were no comments saying, please leave it optional for convalescent. There were several comments saying, please make it required for convalescent services at that level.
Required.
Do anybody want to speak in favor of optional for convalescent services?
We have two large groups of convalescent providers, both with Medic and with Johnson Ambulance Service. it may be the standard on your trucks now. I don't know.
It is.
So you have, it's not an acquisition for you, you've already got.
I'm surprised that risk management let people go without it, whether this is requiring it or not. But.
We're not going to put our rates out there and that kind of thing. That's a liability.
Yeah.
I think the distinguishment here is convalescent is characterized as that hospital-owned entity that transports patients over to Dallas. That's not Medic, and that's not Johnston Ambulance.
But
that's a whole separate classification. They're classified as a ground ambulance.
But they may choose to classify as a ground emergency unit, but you have regulation that puts permits on convalescent ambulances that aren't necessarily hospital-based.
Oh, that's
right. So in the grand environment, though, anyone that's got a permitted ambulance, This would be the bar.
The general consensus was if it says the word ambulance on it anywhere, the public expects there's an AED present on that vehicle.
It's like a convalescent truck does not say ambulance on it.
Right. Okay.
So.
But if it looks like it does.
Yeah. I say, wait a minute. How many are there?
There's not the one or two services that even have convalescent trucks.
Statewide.
Yeah, it used to be Albemarle Hospital, New Care.
Man.
Albemarle Hospital has done away with theirs.
We got to vote for Medic to man up, I think.
Yeah.
Tom,
you
stayed
on
hospital. There you go. Central Regional Hospital and Specialty Care.
Yeah. Longleaf,
yeah, we'll flip this over to required from our recommendation for now, between now and July, and then we can work out if we need to flip it back. But there was pretty good consensus about that.
Did they apply for those grant funds a couple of years back?
So we've already talked about CPAP. They want to just add CO2 detector as an optional piece of equipment, add mechanical CPR device as an optional piece of equipment, and add the impedance threshold device as an optional piece of equipment.
Was it CO? Not CO.
Yeah, CO detector. Yeah, it's carbon monoxide detectors as optional, not required. So far, so good? Okay. The same question about convalescence came up under glucose monitoring. That was only one comment, not nearly as many as about the AED. But there were a few that said, should you require glucose monitoring on convalescent services? One comment. I don't know how much weight we want to give that. I'm open to any conversation about that. I don't feel strongly about that one way or the other. I mean, you know, in North Carolina, if you use a glucometer, you'll find diabetes every day. But the question is that important? All right, and so same comment about pulse oximetry. Again, I'm not sure that we put that on the required list. Multiple comments about the definition of a CPR board, backboard short and long, spinal mobilization extrication device. Is there a way to make that more general because there are multiple devices that could serve all of those purposes? In other words, if you have a KED, does that not count for a short backboard, for example? So several of those kind of comments. We'll clarify that language so that you've got one it that can qualify for multiple of those. The traction device, if you go to the very end, there is a B8 exception. And the B8 exception basically says if you're a non-transport agency, then these devices are optional. And there were at least two or three comments about making a femur traction device a B8 requirement. In other words, it has to be on everything that transports. It doesn't have to be on every QRV. There were a lot of those comments. Is there just strong feeling about that one way or the other? Again, there were no comments in favor of retaining it on non-transport, but there were several that said it should come off of QRV-type vehicles. As a requirement, it could be optional. Everybody good with that? All right, we'll make that change. There's a dissent? The patient's needs did not change. They're based on the QRV is not going to be transporting a patient with a femur fracture anyway. So the, by transport, there will be a femur fracture mobilization device available.
Yeah. It's been a while since I've been on the street, but I thought there was some immediate relief when it was applied.
No, there is immediate relief when it's applied. I think the question is...
So I'd be a fan of keeping it.
Okay.
And not changing it. Sorry.
That's all right. Other discussion? It's required at the moment. And the motions make it optional. Main required. Yes, sir.
I think, I mean, optional, because, I mean, there's always a transport unit coming relatively quickly after. I mean, when you start thinking about all the first responder units in the state that are now required to carry traction plants.
Well, but many system plans are saying there'll be one at the scene.
It's already required. Well, I can tell you, it's been inspected by the state on a fire truck, and it had to be on a fire truck, and that just... Me, being a previous assistant chief of fire foreman, made absolutely no sense to me to have that traction splint because I had a medic truck responding from the same station that had both traction splints. So now I had three traction splints. The only place that came benefit was when my traction splint on the medic truck got stuck at the hospital. I could pull it off the fire truck and just pray the state didn't come by.
Any kind of like a rural county where there are long transport times, that might be a while for after QRB gets there before transport trucks.
Then you're talking about between $365 to $400 of traction splint to sit on the fire truck, collect dust, and never be used.
Yes, sir.
Question.
I was going to make the point that he made. What we got in rural counties where you got all the time and distance for a transport truck gets there, first responders only have that leg.
And I think there's a clarification between making it optional and forbidding it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, we would anticipate the local system to say if there's going to be a prolonged distance between arrival of the QRB and arrival of the transport unit, that the right thing for them to do would be to put it on those units. The question is, do we feel comfortable enough doing that, or do we need to leave it on the required side to make sure it's there?
How many people in here would take it off of their QRB? How many people would leave it on there if it was optional?
I'm just going to take it off for space purpose.
One thing you have to remember, too, is the QRB usually have one person on, but can one person on stake is going to put on the traction plan.
Only through the paramedic competition in Greensboro, then you can. All right, so we've got, we'll make it optional for now, and then we'll allow the good folks from Medic to create a counter argument between now and July. Okay. Next comment was related to the upper and lower extremity immobilization devices, and what exactly was meant by that. And is this restraints, or is this splints, or there was some confusion and people just requested clarification. I think it is restraints, but it may be splints. So we just need to clarify that, and we will. That's just a clarification. Okay, nobody had any comments under bandages other than hemostatic bandages should count as under the dressings, bandages, gauze, rolls, and adhesive tape line. So just put them in there as that. Under medication administration, the MAD device or the mucosal atomizer device as an optional thing. If people felt like that needed to be separate. And the question over the tourniquet under medication administration, does this also, and I believe it does, but just a clarification, does that also cover tourniquets applied for hemostasis, not just applied for IV access? I think people were reading that as that's the tourniquet you put on to get the vein to come up to start the line as opposed to the tourniquet that you would use to do hemorrhage control. I don't think we need to distinguish between those two things. Okay. I didn't think we did either. Just wanted to make sure. Save their phones! People want to take that off and have two mechanisms of communication as the requirement. Sure, as people think about that, that'll create a question.
So the system plan would have to have a primary and secondary mode of communication defined for that community.
Yes. And whether it was...
VHF, UHF, VHF 800, 10 can string, whatever, ham radio, whatever. But if you add up what the cost of maintaining cellular service is and the ready availability of someone's cell phone.
Well, and the option that if you're on the internet, if you've got an air card, right? You've got internet communications and you have voice and whatever else.
The flip side of that, Dr. Myers, right now is it's not a point deduction. It's not anything. Basically, the reason we put it on the check sheet was trying to start tracking who does carry them, who does provide them, and who don't provide them.
Well, in that case, we just need to switch this over to optional then, because this document makes it appear as if it's required.
Absolutely.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. Almost finished. The last comment that we received all related around this latex allergy, latex-free gloves, latex this, that, or the other thing, and I think the consensus was that that latex allergy must be addressed and leave it at that, because most of our systems now, I think, don't have anything with latex in them anyway. So there's no need, and it says if using latex-free equipment, all the stars and asterisks, but it was cumbersome, and so people just wanted to say, address latex allergy, and you just say how you've done it. That summarizes all of our 12 pages of comments, but I'll be happy to take other things people want to make optional, add, subtract, multiply, divide. There were a couple of questions about stair chair issues. Two comments wanted to remove them. We just didn't feel like that removing stair chairs was an option.
And so, whether or not the soft carry system is equal to a stair chair. The Furno manufactures a easily stored seat that's a fabric seat with handles. Does that qualify?
Is it what, red QT?
I think that's what it's called.
And that'll turn into the rest of your sheet.
Yeah.
And that'll...
We interjected something about bariatric movement.
Okay.
Given our patient populations today, it's a minimal expense, about $20, $25 for a 1,500-pound capable rolled-up movement device. I don't remember how we...
I think we left it as, could you get it to the scene? We didn't want to put it on every... And that would be more of a reference to a system plan than to this, yeah. The only two things that were to be referred out is there was a request for EMT intermediates to be able to do chest decompression, which I think just got filtered to the wrong committee, so whoever is looking at that will just have to think about whether that is reasonable or not. I'm sorry?
Nebulization. Can
we
go back to the cell phone for one moment?
Yes, sir.
Consider putting the cell phone mandatory back instead of optional, because if you leave it optional, the county manager and the board of commissioners will say it's not required. It'll be a financial thing that they'll take on.
Well, we view it in the opposite way.
Leave it the way it is and let the state say we're not taking points off. That's how we get to keep ours, because we say it's mandatory.
All right.
Because we have air cards for our computers. We have a cell phone for the backup today. We have radios. If we say optional for any of those, they'll say, you don't need them.
But our counter to that was your system plan reflects your methodology, primary and secondary methodology. You could still maintain cellular phones as your secondary.
So you're required to have two.
This specifies a specific mode of communication, which in all communities may not be available at time of need, nor the most efficient. I hear what you're saying.
I understand, but you see the financial part coming from
that. Yeah, I do. And the reverse on that, when I've got 50 trucks that have to have.
Yeah.
He's not a former EMS employee. Only a few of those.
They send me the proof.
And I think we require two forms of communication, but you'd still have the same shelter. To say that this is our primary, this is our secondary, this is what we have to have.
Jack has the requirement of a push to talk device on the ship to make it to be the same radio frequency and not a secondary system. So,
it's optional. I mean, we don't count on points for the check sheet, so that's up for discussion.
That's the only reason I say this is this document becomes discoverable and used both for us and against us. If our intent is to make options, then we should, at the end of the day, have it set there. If not, then it needs to reflect what reality is, what the expectations of the provider.
That's one end of the day.
Any other questions? Anything we want to add? Anything else? The only other thing was, and Joseph brought it up, and it's dark out here, so that I missed it on the way by because the ink matched in the thing. Nebulizer under EMT needs to be optional, and that's just to bring it in compliance with the state protocol. It's just a clerical issue. The way it shows, you cannot have a nebulizer on an EMT unit, which if the system likes to do so, we can just make that optional. That's just housekeeping stuff. Anything else?
Anyone on the phones, 5-star, raise your hand. Hearing none?
I think so.
Wands open.
Okay. He one muted me about an hour and a half ago. And
yeah, he was muted.
Yeah, sorry. He texted me, I just saw it.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Never a doubt in my mind.
Thanks a whole lot. That's excellent. Thank you. It's a big summary of this document that long.
So who's next? We're getting close. Whatever pops up.
Stats.
Oh, well, now we're doing stats for EMD until after lunch.
Want me to do...
Oh, well, whatever.
Yeah, we...
I click the slide.
Yeah, I understand. That was the posted... We do want to come to that, but I got folks who aren't showing up here until after lunch because we agreed on what went out.
Right.
Yeah, you did. So let's next.
Oh, yeah.
We'll come back. Who's next after? I had equipment and then the protocols original office.
Protocols, this would be
actual.
Protocols 11-12, right?
How about policies? Are you ready for that?
Juan, can you hear me out there?
Yeah, man.
Do you want me to do the medical director qualifications now? Because I should be able to knock that out in about 10 to 15 minutes.
That sounds good. Let's do that. Go right ahead.
Shouldn't take more than about 10 to 15 minutes. For those folks who were not available for the two prior meetings, there were a number of survey comments regarding medical director qualifications. I think one of the biggest concerns was they felt some medical directors clearly were not active members of the EMS community and felt that they were never there. And so two comments that did come out quite a bit was in regards to EMS ride-alongs. And this would sort of encourage the medical directors to be more involved. The other comment was in regards to the medical directors don't even show up to the meetings, whether that's quality management, et cetera. And so based on those comments, the two biggest additions that we have, again, that have added to the draft were to attend the quarterly EMS System Performance Improvement Committee meetings and serve as chair of the committee. And then the second item, which that would be item 13, that would be added to the list of, I believe, current qualifications. The next would be to ride along with EMS and provide on-site medical direction a minimum of 16 hours per year or respond to 8 scene responses per year, excluding their own office or practice. And again, that was to clarify for those physicians who have sort of a private practice office, just because the ambulance shows up to their office, that doesn't quite count. One of the concerns that we had was in regards to how do we assure that the medical directors are compliant and actually have done these things. And as requirements that must be maintained under item 4 that we added was maintain records of compliance with education and training requirements above and produce same upon request by local EMS and or North Carolina Office of EMS. With the idea is that when the state does a site visit, whether it's checking the equipment on ambulances, it can go ahead on a yearly basis and go ahead and, as appropriate, check to make sure that the records regarding that medical director are accurate.
Hey, Juan?
Yeah.
I got someone on the phone who wants to ask you a question.
Certainly. Go ahead.
Hold on one second. Go ahead if you have a question.
Yes, just clarification on the ride-along and on-scene medical direction. The insurance coverage to provide liability insurance for some EMS directors does not cover on-scene. So to make that a requirement seems problematic. It depends on your liability coverage for patient care and the liability insurance you have, you know, in your clinical setting, you know, may not apply to providing on-scene care. Like, I ride along on my ambulance, but to provide care, I know for a fact I'm not covered.
Wow. I've never heard that before.
Comments or thoughts from anyone in the room?
They're in shock.
Well, and I'm at a CMC. A CMC facility provides my insurance. Administrative only.
Right along and provide medical direction, but don't deliver any care.
That's right. And I work for a contract management organization that covers my clinical practice, and they do not cover it.
I know the National Association of EMS Physicians had this issue come up several years ago, and I know there is at least one insurance carrier that will cover liability for medical direction.
But to mandate across the state, you know, additional insurance coverage, I think the wording of that could be made in such a way that, you know, you don't have that additional expense.
Would it be acceptable to put ride along with EMS a minimum of 16 hours per year and provide on-site medical direction?
I see. You know, something to where you don't have to mandate that insurance coverage, you know, you're right. A ride-along time for 16 hours, I think, is more than appropriate. But, you know, that's just, I know for a fact, if we look at these agencies across the state, the nuances of all these different insurance coverages are difficult and problematic and expensive.
I think we should note your situation.
One thing I would say is that that's not our definition of medical malpractice or medical liability coverage is required. So the ability to function as a medical director means that you do need to be able to function out in the field. So the state requirement for liability coverage would not be met by what was just described.
Maybe offline we can have it put you in contact with some folks.
Okay.
Yeah, but I think this is a bigger issue that you bring up, that it's an important one for our state, and I think the nation for that matter. To my knowledge, there currently is only one insurance carrier that specifically covers EMS medical direction per se. There are obviously some carriers out there, you know, for the university, for example, but and they say they will cover it. You know, and I've got a few emails to back that up, just in case, gosh forbid, it were to occur. But I think you bring up an important point for the average EMS medical director in some of our smaller counties who potentially could not afford themselves insurance coverage. You know, how is that done, and how much liability do they have providing EMS medical direction in the field? I recall, and I don't know if anyone is there who's old enough, But as I recall, the North Carolina general statutes make a comment about EMS medical direction if it's a non-reimbursed position.
Hey, this is Greg again. We never allow that to be your sole mechanism for med-mal coverage because essentially if they give you a car, if they give you a radio, if they buy you lunch, if they pay for a book, you're paid. So, you know, no one as a volunteer can rely on that. It takes about 5 minutes to disqualify you on a stand with that attempt. So everyone is required to have med-mal coverage for EMS, and there are more than one carrier. I actually was one of the individuals, you know, 10 years ago that worked with the existing carrier you're talking about, Juan, to get this set up to where there would be a dedicated policy for EMS that was cost-effective. And that is the major one that's still out there. And if anybody needs that contact, I can certainly provide it to them. So there is not a difficulty in obtaining coverage. And certainly coverage should protect you for the provision of medical care in a pre-hospital setting. And that it should be something you can work with. It's a CMC issue. I think that probably is more of a clarification on their aspect that one, it's a requirement for your physician, and two, that it needs to be more clarified or stipulated for that role.
But as far as this new requirement, I think if we kept the language simple, it would be easier to maintain that credential.
I think by just putting the word ride along with EMS, it leaves it very open and allows those individuals who potentially would not have any liability coverage. I think the issue goes back to when you're in that position, you know, the Good Samaritan, you know, are you just an observer? Well, as a physician, it's kind of hard to just be an observer if something's going awry. And I think that becomes the issue.
Exactly. Thank you.
One more?
One of the other comments that was added in was in regards to item Section B under requirements, completion of the North Carolina College of Emergency Physicians Medical Director's course within the first year of appointment and or NAMSP online medical director's online curriculum within the first year of practice beginning in 2012. And for those who aren't aware, the National Association of EMS Physicians does have an online medical director's online curriculum. It's about a day-long course. And that came up as a potential option instead of having to go to multiple courses. I don't know how folks felt about that. That was one of the other additions. As a clarification to that, it is recommended that those medical directors approved before 2012 complete the last module of the NAMSP Medical Directors Online Curriculum, which will be North Carolina specific. And the idea of that NAMSP curriculum is that the last module is basically state specific, developed by the state for the state.
Do I have a question?
Any comments from?
One thing we may need to keep in mind in doing this. And what are we going to require? If we require the ride-along for with EMS, you know, for instance, I think there's some medical director here for the highway patrol. Are they going to have to do a ride-along with EMS, that type of instance, or are we going to make an exclusion where I'm not sure what we would do with that type of situation. And there are others out there, but I think there's a representative from the highway patrol here.
Juan, did you hear that?
Yes, I did, and I think that's an excellent point. But I think the goal really was to get and to be fair, those physicians typically are much more active in terms of, you know, responding to events and scenes, although it might be delayed. But I think the biggest concern really was to focus on those physicians in the community who aren't very active, who don't work in the emergency department, and really get them out in the streets to see what the EMS folks are doing out there. I'm sure there can always be exemptions, but I think this goes back to the process itself and how the North Carolina Office of EMS what our goals are as medical directors, you know, as a whole. How many medical directors are out there in the audience today? Raise your hand so we can get an idea.
Can you see that one?
No, I can't. How many?
We've got about 11 to 14.
How many of those 11 or 14 folks out there, about how many of them would think that a ride along with EMS would be very appropriate and would be relatively easy to do? Raise your hands.
I'd have to take my shoe off.
Any opposed.
Yeah. Any opposed, yeah.
So, any opposed. It'd be a whole lot easier to count that.
How many folks would think it's a bad idea and would be very difficult to do?
We've got one.
One hand raised?
Hand raised.
Because he's looking at her system there, affiliated with this thing just overall. Like you got one that's affiliated with five systems.
So the question is, if you're affiliated with five systems, do you have to ride with all five?
Well, no, I think the goal of, and it reads, and let me reread it with the new latest changes, ride along with EMS a minimum of 16 hours per year or respond to 8 scene responses per year, excluding their own office/practice. So it doesn't say who you can do the ride-alongs with. I guess theoretically you could do your ride-alongs in Miami or New York City if you wanted to when you're on vacation. But I think the primary goal is to really get those providers who clearly aren't connected with EMS out there to really hook up with their providers. So I'll pick on the family doctor who clearly does not ride with EMS on any regular basis, is not part of that agency, and does not work in the emergency department. So the only time his interaction with EMS is when they are actually in the office picking up a patient headed to the emergency department. And so they never go to a motor vehicle collision. They never go and take care of that patient who's brought in from, you know, the private residence.
To be fair, Juan, that's a generalization.
Right, and I'm just picking on one case that I know, for example. But I think the goal is to really get the medical directors more interactive with their providers.
All right, but medical directors interactive with their providers is not necessarily 911 EMS if they're specialty care.
Absolutely, and so
is it the environment that they are providing medical direction? Is that the intent of the ride along?
No, I think when we talked about it and discussed it in the subcommittee, one of the concerns that we had, and I think the concerns from the survey, is that the subspecialty folks, they're acting, and they're very close to their providers in terms of skills training, education, quality management. What we're really, the concern that was brought up clearly from the survey was that there were individual EMS medical directors out there that have no idea what EMS does. They couldn't spell EMS if it was, you know, more than three letters. And the real concern was to really get those medical directors who aren't really active with their providers and those EMS professionals really more interactive with them. And we realized that by doing the ride-alongs, at least they would have a better idea of what EMS does and how they do it.
All right, comments from the audience? All right, we will host that meeting in Greenville. Do you want to voice your concern about that?
Well, yeah, it sounds like this whole thing is set up to deal with those few that are private practice that aren't involved. I mean, I live in the emergency room. I'm on the phone with them giving medical direction on scene and in route more times a day than I would like to. I mean, I get taken away from patient care. Dr. Guzzer does, all of us do. I mean, we're extremely involved in EMS. We meet and greet those guys, the patients, several times a day. I mean, Onslow County, population of 170-some thousand, we're extremely busy. Ask guys to pit how often they have to come down and pick up our patients. So sounds like his thing was for the family practice guy who doesn't show up at meetings or anything. Well, I'm the chairman of our peer review quarterly meeting and always there. Dr. Guzzer and I show up and do oral boards whenever somebody's taken them and not done so well, so they have us sit in for their final try to say yes or no, you're not coming on board. I mean, we're heavily involved, and as I say, at work, we talk with them supervisor, when there's been a bad crash with multiple people involved, talk to them, trying to learn things about on scene, and we're actually teaching them what things you should have been looking at to report to us, like, you know, where the damage was, what kind of damage it was, that kind of stuff. So, like I said, we're extremely actively involved all day long at work, every day that we're there. And it sounds like this is geared toward a rare person that's in a private practice in a small community that's not really involved in EMS. So, you know, putting that requirement on us, I'm not sure what it's going to gain other than, you know, giving up a couple of days, a couple of full days a year around on an ambulance.
And we understand your position. I think the issue we felt when we talked about it was that those, again, it was only 16 hours per year in ride-alongs or 8 scene responses per year. I can't comment on, you know, how many hours you've spent in the field or, you know, obviously you're interactive and are really an active member of the quality management committee and of your EMS community. But I think by not making a huge number of hours, but by making some minimum number of hours. And again, it's only 16 hours, so theoretically, you know, 1 hour every one day every 6 months would be enough to meet this requirement.
Well, we could get 18 responses in about 2 hours exactly.
Got another comment.
And I think that was the other issue too for agencies that are very slow. To make them go to 8 scene responses, they might only have 2 calls in those 16 hours. You know, at the same time, for folks who decide, you know, to respond directly or who might stop off at a scene to assist. But I think the goal is to assure that clearly that medical director understands EMS and really is in some way, shape, or form connecting with their providers. And whether they sit in the station for 8 hours and kind of just they chew his ear or her ear for 8 hours, or whether they're actually on scenes, on the scene of those accidents and responses.
I better move on to the next part of the recommendation system. We're getting tight on time. Let me get this comment from the back. Go ahead.
I listened to discussion. I cannot tell if there's any differentiation between here and your staff here. Because I think that's the question. Because I think
so the question is, we can't differentiate by the point whether specialty care medical directors would be required to spend 16 hours or 8 calls on specifically EMS-based units, 911-based units versus their own units.
And this was for all medical directors. It did not if you look at the document on the top of page 2, qualifications for medical director of an EMS specialty care transport, it would require the requirements in Section 1, which would indeed be that ride-along.
All right, good discussion. I guess this will be followed up with feedback once we put the draft out.
How many medical directors from EMS specialty care transport agencies are in attendance today? If they could raise their hand.
Got about 4 or 5.
Of those, how many of you would think it would be a significant burden to do a 16 hours of ride-along? Raise your hand.
With EMS or with our own people?
Any EMS ride-along, not specific. It does not clarify it. It leaves it very open.
Our staff's point was to have contact with your crew. I would instantly submit the spec here group has to live with them 24/7.
What were those? Could you repeat those comments out loud? I didn't hear all of them.
So there's a question about outcome-based intent behind this. I think we're going to have to move it offline because we've got to cut off at noon.
Understand.
Can you give me a summary for the remainder of your comments on assistance?
And the only other item was a comment regarding that the assistant medical director could serve as the chair for the Performance Improvement Committee if appointed by the system medical director.
Okay.
Those were the only major, again, those were, again, not many items, but I know there was a lot of discussion regarding that ride-along.
And I think there will be more discussion as the word gets out. Thank you, Juan.
Thank you.
Back on
it. We're going to break so we can stay on time. We're going to pick back up at 1, and we're going to hit protocols first, and then we'll hit EMD. So we're going to drop the line, folks. We'll get you to call back in at 1 o'clock. Thank you. Restrooms, round of applause.